Hi, it's John Amundson, and I want to welcome you to the next podcast in our series of podcasts presented for you by the Psychologist Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information that's timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership. I started off with Bruce Springsteen, something about you have to have a spark to start a fire, because the article I want to speak about initially is a recently published article. And it was the first online posting. I think I've said this over and over that I, as a member of APA their gold standard, they send me each week all the journals that and articles that are coming out. So I scroll down through, you know, all these different articles and try to pull out some that are, you know, interesting for the membership, timely, topical, and controversial. And this one is on curiosity, and it is in the Journal of Individual Differences, and the title is Being Snoopy and Smart, the Relationship Between Curiosity, Fluid Intelligence, and Knowledge. And I really liked it because I have done articles on the issue of motivation versus ambition. Psych Bulletin put something out a few years ago and said, is the pursuit of status a stand-in sort of for ambition, a separate drive and trait, or is it just a downstream product of other drives? And that article determined that ambition does seem to have a singular quality to it in each individual. In other words, people are differentially loaded on ambition. I have distinguished differentiated between ambition and motivation. And this article gives truth to Amundsen's utterances regarding that difference. All right, so let's take a look at it. What they were looking at is curiosity, and they say curiosity is a basic driver that exists in individuals. And what they were looking at is what the authors call episystemic curiosity. And they said this is a curiosity that is beyond simple perceptual curiosity. Perceptual curiosity is seeing something and trying to see what it is and where it fits. Episystemic is a desire to acquire new knowledge elicited by new and complex ideas or conceptual ambiguities, more of a cognitive process. It is the expression of motivation. People who have episystemic curiosity are akin to individuals like Richard Feynman. Feynman was a physicist who won the Nobel Prize, and if you read the stories of his life, the biographies that have been written about him, he was just an infinitely episystemic, curious individual. So that he would, the example I remember from the book, Surely You're Kidding, Mr. Feynman, or Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, was them talking about seeing ants in his house and then looking at ant trails and then trying to interfere with ant trails and just being profoundly episystemically curious, reasoning around the ants and their behavior. Also, he became an expert with the bongo drums. This is the 50s and bongo drums were popular. And the idea of different sorts of rhythms and how they were determined and cultural aspects of drumming. So, the reason this is important is I think the distinction between ambition, which is pursuit of some status, versus motivation is critical for psychologists. Psychologists that are epistemically curious will be very different from psychologists that are simply ambitious. What they found was, in fact, that individuals that are high in epistemic curiosity acquire knowledge. And this knowledge is in a circular relationship to reasoning. Epistemically curious individuals enrich their environment, which in turn enhances their cognitive ability. So as they're curious about and reasoning about things going on around them, this enriches the world, but it also enriches their cognitive capacities. So it's pretty cool. I think we ought to all hope that we are more epistemically curious than simply ambitiously driven. I want to go into a second article, so to speak. It's actually a quick review of a book. Now, I haven't read the book, so I'm reading the review by others. And it's a book called 1,000 Ways to Pay Attention, A Memoir of Coming Home to My Neurodivergent Mind. And it's written by a journalist, a person who has written for a number of significant publications, British. And so she comes in as a science writer. And it's autobiographical in the sense that she says, I've come home to my neurodivergent classification. And the review of the book essentially expresses is this idea of the diversity within ADHD, and then the need to call it neurodivergent. She likes that better than the separate classificatory systems. As she says in her book, I see in myself a number of different symptoms. And we know as practitioners that people will come in and they'll say, well, I'm adult ADHD. Well, they could also have been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive personality disorder or disorder, or another personality or character disorder. They could have also been diagnosed as suffering from anxiety, generalized anxiety disorder. Often they'll report the same sort of symptoms. I have obsessive thoughts. I can't focus. I can't persist at a task. There are depressive qualities. There are, and I'm using the term not as a personality disorder, but asocial or antisocial expressions. So people will sometimes seek the title ADHD in order to cover a myriad of sins, so to speak. And so she likes neurodivergent. And this kind of dovetails into something that I've spoken of before. Now, in terms of full disclosure, I was held back in grade 3. In those days, they didn't call it attention deficit disorder. They called it MBD, minimal brain dysfunction. And then later it became minimal cerebral dysfunction. And then it was just called hyperactivity. So that the diagnosis was being sharpened. Leon Edinger, and I've talked about him in other podcasts, was a guy I knew. And Leon Edinger was the godparent of a pediatrician, the godparent of attention deficit disorders through the 50s and into the 60s. You know, just dropping a few names, and also was able to speak to him a few times about this whole issue. So we know that this idea of ADHD is going to be a difficult one for us to wrestle with. Is it a term of convenience? Is it a differential? And do we consider it a differential out of the earlier sorts of diagnoses I spoke of? In her book, though, she does talk about this and covers the things in her life where she has experienced the myriad of symptoms that can be classified there under. Now, I keep saying the reason, but part of the reasoning I have about this is I have said that I believe that sometime in the future we'll have concentrative thought disorder or concentrative disorders, and this concentrative will be about concentration. things that impede or get in the way of concentration. So that ADHD will be a subset of that. But I like hers better because increasingly we, those of us who have been diagnosed at some time in our lives, have been pushed into a neurodivergent. And then there's an increasing social sensitivity to the neurodivergent, for example, in the schools, the integration programs, as opposed to segregation and the separation of individuals who are, quote, neurodivergent into other classrooms or educational venues. All right, so there's kind of the latest on her book, at least. And again, I read the review, so I don't have to read the book. In a final article in the Journal of Research and Personality, a couple of researchers, I think there's four or five of them, write on pain and the role of narrative in the experience of pain. They were looking at endometriosis, which is a very painful disorder suffered predominantly by women, but certainly something of significance for medical practitioners when I was working in a primary healthcare setting, and they had a person specializing in this because it was becoming such a frequent complaint, medical complaint and diagnosis. They were examining the relationship between personal narrative, identity, mental health, and pain. And many years ago, I had an article in the Dulwith Center newsletter. That was Michael White's publication. He had a publication that came out of Dulwich. And I wrote on pain in a very similar fashion to what they speak of in this article. What they say is this, that the more pain has been centralized to one's personal narrative, the greater the level of discomfort and in mental health, physical discomfort, and mental health discomfort. So what I spoke of in the article and what they talk about here is essentially that pain moves in and seeks to centralize itself to the organization of the patient's life so that other potential sources of identity or narrative understanding are squeezed out. And the way I described it in the article and the way I've treated it over the years is pain has a life of its own. It wants to be more and more significant. As it moves into your life, it requires you to check into it, to analyze it, to continue to investigate it in the same way a graduate student will write a thesis or a dissertation. As one is peering into the pain issue, the threshold lowers. So the sensate threshold lowers, we pay more attention. As we pay more attention, the threshold lowers and on and on and on. And in the article that I wrote, I said the difference between the a cold presser test and doing another run downhill skiing at sunshine, it's very little difference in terms of the actual discomfort. You're at sunshine, it's minus 18, you're going to do one more run. Cold pressers, when you put your hand in a bucket of ice water and they look at how long you can hold, keep it in there. But the difference is really in the narrative that's around that. And so the more that we centralize the experience of discomfort to our lives, the more it pushes out other potential identity features. And then the article, the elaborative article on this, I was reading two articles, the actual article, and then one discussing it, that the more it pushes out these other identities, the more the person actually becomes an ally of pain. That is, they seek to justify, rationalize, and defend it. And so when people begin to question it and try to break away from the narrative, it is often perceived as being critical of the sufferer. In other words, you're not doing enough. It's all in your head. You're making way too much of it in order to acquire some secondary gain, and on and on. So the poor patient then has to become an ally of the pain because there may be a seemingly skeptical audience around. But they also said that people who are able to escape the narrative, that is, it will not be my entire definition of my identity, suffer less, not only in a mental health sense, but also physically. So there's another kind of interesting hit on this. And I think probably something that can be useful for the clinicians that are working in rehabilitation psychology or with chronic pain. So let's let House of Pain march us out.